The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening and welcome. This happens to be both the last evening of the class on daily life practice and the first evening on the class on the paramis. They overlapped. The topic overlapped. So I thought I would start the next series essentially this evening. But I do want to begin a little bit tonight before I actually go into the talk, which is basically an overview of the paramis, which is the paramis are 10 beautiful qualities of heart and mind that are cultivated as we engage in this practice. And so I'll give a talk about these qualities tonight to overview them as a whole. And then for the subsequent 9 weeks, there'll be one talk, pretty much one talk per week on each of these qualities, so that we'll go into a little more depth on each of these qualities. But before I talk about that, I want to just check in with those of you who've been participating in the daily life practice and see if there's any comments or any explorations that you've engaged in that you're willing to talk about, particularly around intention and purpose and motivation, which is what we talked about last week. Does anybody have anything they wanted to share around those explorations? Okay. So these qualities, the term parami is a Pali word that basically means something like perfection. And there are said to be 10 qualities or 10 perfections that are cultivated as we engage in this practice. So not only are they cultivated, but essentially they manifest as we engage in this practice. So they are both practices that we engage in actively trying to cultivate these qualities, and they, as we progress and move and engage in our practice, they begin to appear. So they are essentially a set of qualities that kind of describe a map of the open heart. So as the heart opens in our practice, these qualities begin to be revealed. And we can actively engage in practices that cultivate them. So the 10 qualities, the 10 perfections, are generosity, ethics, or virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination or resolve, kindness or loving kindness, and equanimity. So over the course of the next few weeks, we will be exploring these in depth. Now, the reason, or part of the reason why I chose to include this topic as a part of the daily life practice series is that these particular qualities are held in the Theravadin tradition, in the tradition from Southeast Asia that we carry here, the lineage of Buddhist teachings that we carry here. These qualities are said to be the practice of daily life, the practice of lay life. So in Southeast Asia, if you go to a monastery for a few months, you might be practicing meditation at a monastery, and then after your period of time at the monastery, the teacher might tell you, well, go work on your paramis. Go work on your qualities of generosity and virtue and kindness and truthfulness. So these are the practices that are said to be really part of our daily life practice. And since we've been exploring practice in daily life, I wanted to bring up these qualities and ways to work with them, ways to practice with them in our daily lives. There's a kind of a mythology of the Buddha's former lives. They're called the Jataka tales. And there's a bunch of them, some more than 500 or so stories about that are supposed to be about the Buddha when he was living in former lives. And they read very much like Aesop's fables. They have a lot of stories about animals, you know, rats and pigeons and quails doing things and learning lessons. And they're kind of children's stories, a lot of them. And the moral, essentially, around each of these stories usually is centered around one of these 10 qualities of mind, one of these 10 paramis. So these qualities of mind are said to be in this mythological way are said to be the qualities that the Buddha cultivated in the many, many lifetimes that he lived prior to his lifetime of becoming the Buddha. So that's a kind of a way in which they're seen, is that they're the ground, they're the way that we start with cultivating these qualities, and from these qualities, as we engage and cultivate these qualities, our hearts open and our practice unfolds through the cultivation of these qualities. So I'll talk a little bit, and this will be really kind of a whirlwind tour through the 10 paramis, because there's not a lot of time with 10 qualities and only another 50 minutes. So, I'll just kind of briefly review these 10 qualities and talk a little bit about each one and how they kind of relate together, how they kind of support each other, and how they're seen as supporting, leading from one to another. So the first one, generosity. In many places in the Buddhist teachings, the Buddha starts his teaching with a teaching on generosity as a place to begin, as a place to begin to open to this practice of letting go. And when we think about what generosity is, it is actually a letting go. We are physically letting go of something. So this is kind of the basic ground of our practice, offering something that we have to others. It provides a connection. When we engage in generosity, it provides a connection to others from one to another through this practice of giving. And giving, it means many, many different things. We can give material things and money, which is kind of often the way we think about it. We can also give our time, our attention. I like to think about how my life can be considered as resources. I have resources of time, of money. I have material things to offer, and how do I want to use those resources, my attention, how do I want to use my resources to live my life, to support my intentions, as I was talking about last week. I mentioned this topic of generosity last week with respect to bringing our purposeful engagement to looking at our resources and how we want to live our lives. This practice also is the beginning of cultivating a non-clinging, of letting go. Because we are letting go of what we are giving. So it supports that initial aspect of understanding what it means to let go. In Asia, they teach this quality of generosity from a very young age. When I have been privileged enough on one retreat I was on, I was able to follow the monks on their alms round and just observe how the people engaged with the giving. And it was really just so beautiful to see how people really brought their whole being into the giving of their spoonful of rice. And this was a poor village I'm talking about. It's not a wealthy village. But along this road, there were hundreds of people lined up to offer some spoonfuls of rice to the monks. And following along, actually, after the monks, was a big wheelbarrow with a huge vat in it, because about halfway through, all the monks' bowls were too full to accept more rice. And so they all emptied their bowls into the big vat and then continued on so the people could continue to offer the rice. And children lined the road. Small children would line the road. And from the time they're babies, their mothers will take a baby's hand and scoop it into the rice and then have the baby drop the food into the monk's bowls. So this is a training that is given in, particularly in Buddhist countries. It's a training that's kind of lacking in our own country. As we engage in this practice, one of the things that we see is that there's a kind of a joy about giving. If you just pay attention to what it feels like, it's said that if you are giving from the heart, that there's joy both before, during, and after the act of giving. There's joy in contemplating the giving. There's the joy in the giving itself. And there's the joy in reflecting on the giving. So generosity is a place to begin cultivating this quality of both joy and of letting go. The second parami, virtue, is one of the keys or the links between paramis, is that it's said that the parami following the preceding parami in some way perfects the preceding parami. This is partly why they're called the perfections. So it's said that the practice of virtue perfects generosity. And it's said that it does this because as we cultivate virtue, we give one of the dearest gifts that's possible to give. And that's the gift of fearlessness. And as we engage in a non-harming way, we offer a gift of generosity, of safety for others in our realm, others that come into contact with us. This is a way in which it's said that virtue perfects generosity. So again, virtue is about connection with others. It's not so much of a moral issue, and I think I talked about this also last week some, so I'll be very brief here. But this is not the exploration of virtue, the exploration of non-harming, is not about right and wrong in this practice. It's not so much about thou shalt not do things. It's more about looking at the practicality of what supports our well-being. And harming others rarely actually supports our well-being. In the Buddhist sense, it would be considered that harming others actually never supports our well-being. So to look at if there is some kind of harm that's going to unfold from our actions. Really to take a look at that. Particularly if you feel like this is something that will somehow benefit you if you harm another. But in some way, that's a misunderstanding. So really take a look at that. So in engagement with these practices, there are practices of virtue. The five precepts are the basic practices of virtue. Refraining from killing, refraining from stealing, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from false speech, and refraining from intoxicants. As we cultivate these, they also in turn, as we actually engage in the action of non-harming, they in turn cultivate positive qualities of mind. So refraining from killing cultivates compassion. Refraining from stealing cultivates contentment. Refraining from sexual misconduct cultivates fidelity. Refraining from false speech cultivates truthfulness. Refraining from intoxication cultivates clarity of mind. So these beautiful qualities are pulled along as we engage in this practice of non-harming. The third is renunciation. And renunciation, we can see in a sense that in the engagement with this non-harming, there can be some renunciation, that we may wish to do some things that we refrain from doing because we are engaging in this cultivation of non-harming. So with the cultivation of virtue, we're looking more at the cultivation of action, actions that are skillful, avoiding actions that are unskillful. With renunciation, we move beyond looking at actions and more deeply into looking at renouncing unskillful habits of mind. So virtue is said to be perfected through renunciation because virtue is really the outward manifestation of these actions. We can act virtuously even if our minds are not quite in line with our actions. And the renunciation perfects or begins to refine, kind of like a goldsmith, refining gold, pulling the impurities out of gold. Renunciation begins to purify our minds of the movement towards unskillful actions. The movements towards these unskillful intentions, which I talked about last week. So renunciation, another way to think about renunciation, another way to frame the word, is as letting go. Really, renunciation is about letting go. So letting go of what is not helpful for our movement towards happiness. Letting go of what is not helpful towards our movement towards freedom. Towards not suffering. So habits of mind, as we engage with this practice of looking at unskillful habits of mind. Oftentimes we don't have a lot of control over our minds. That's what we learn as we engage in this meditation practice, that we don't have a lot of control over our minds. But this practice of witnessing, of simply observing what's happening. So, anger appears in our mind. an unskillful movement. Can we really renounce anger? That's a hard thing to do. You know, anger appears. What renunciation could mean in this case is renouncing the acting on the anger in favor of simply being willing to observe it. That's a form of renunciation. It's a form of letting go in a way of letting be, rather than following through on the impulses that the anger generates. Simply see if you can observe the anger. This is more powerful than you can imagine, actually, this letting be, as opposed to engaging or acting on our habits of mind. There's an analogy I like to use, and I know some of you have heard it, so bear with me, but sometimes it's interesting to hear them more than once. With mindfulness and paying attention to difficult mind states like anger, you know, when we're engaged in a difficult mind state like that, it's like the mind has all this momentum behind it. It's got all this force of just this impulse to head in that direction towards anger, because we've got so much of habits kind of behind us, heading us in that direction. It's like we're in a car on the freeway going at 60 miles an hour. That's the way our mind has got that kind of momentum to it. And all of the thoughts, all of the way in which our mind churns around that anger, that's like putting our foot on the accelerator pedal. That's what keeps the anger going. That's what keeps the car moving. You don't keep going. The car doesn't keep moving unless you've got the foot on the accelerator. Likewise with the anger. The anger itself is accelerated and kept in motion through the thoughts. So if we can turn our attention away from the thoughts and just observe the anger come into the body, what does the body feel like? What does it feel like to be a human being that's angry? Seeing letting go of the thoughts as much as possible. When you let go of the thoughts, it's like taking your foot off the accelerator pedal when you're going down the freeway at 60 miles an hour. Now, the car's not going to come to a stop immediately when you take your foot off the accelerator pedal, because there is that momentum. And likewise, simply turning the mind towards anger is not going to stop the anger. We get to experience the results of that anger in our bodies. But if we commit to renouncing the thoughts, letting go of the thoughts as much as possible, it will let go of itself. That anger will wear itself out. That momentum of the anger will wear itself out, much as a car would just slowly roll to a stop when you take your foot off the accelerator pedal. So that's the way mindfulness functions for us a lot of the times. And that's a very legitimate way to engage in renunciation. So we don't have to think of renunciation as telling our minds to try to cut things out, to say, stop that. But more being willing to be open to the experience of these unskillful habits of mind without putting the accelerator on with them. So there's a way in which we think we know what's going to make us happy. We think we know that if only we can get what we want and get rid of what we don't want and arrange the world the way we want it, that happiness will follow. So we're kind of outwardly focused with respect to happiness. But what we learn through this practice is that that is actually a myth, that we can become happy through arranging the world. As soon as we arrange the world, it breaks down. And we have to arrange it again. We engage in this never-ending process of arranging and watching it break down, and arranging and watching it break down, and wonder why we never really finally get happy. There's a quote from the Dhammapada. If by giving up a lesser happiness, one could experience greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. And that's essentially what this kind of renunciation is about, is letting go of the smaller kinds of happiness in favor of a much more unconstructed happiness, a happiness that doesn't depend on the conditions of the world. It takes a leap of faith. One teacher had a beautiful quote about renunciation. He said, what we actually do over and over again is we renounce our freedom by the way we engage in the world. We renounce our freedom as we choose our habits of mind over letting go. I found that to be a beautiful thing to reflect on. The fourth parami is wisdom. So with wisdom, we begin by understanding what is worth renouncing. So getting a sense or learning through our experience, through this practice of mindfulness, we begin to get a sense of what is worth renouncing. Because we see as we engage in this practice that it is worth letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion. When we let go of those qualities, we are left with a feeling of openness, of connection, of happiness. So wisdom is about discriminating or learning what leads us towards true happiness and what leads us away from it. And that's essentially the definition of skillful and unskillful. Skillful qualities of mind are what lead us to happiness. Unskillful qualities of mind are what lead us to suffering. Wisdom also is coming back again to this observing, this wise attention, observing our experience. The first noble truth, understand suffering. The first noble truth is there is suffering, and the suggestion the Buddha made about this noble truth is to understand it. Wise attention to understand suffering. When we understand suffering, we begin to see how it's created in our experience. We begin to see what's happening in our minds to hold it in place. And we begin to understand how it can let go. So as we observe our experience, we begin to learn. Through this wise attention, we begin to really clearly learn what supports happiness and what doesn't support happiness. So mindfulness itself, this wise attention, is our guide, cutting this path through our experience, showing us what's skillful and what's unskillful. Now there's different levels to wisdom, different layers to wisdom. There's a level of just hearing things and reading things, where we take things in. So hearing Dharma talks or reading books. That's a way of gathering wisdom. Then there's our own reflection on what we have read, how we understand it, taking it in and thinking about it, using our reflective capacity of mind to think about, how do I understand what I've read? And then there is the experiential, putting those understandings that we've learned and reflected on into practice in our lives. And this Buddhist teaching, the teaching from the Buddha, is nothing if not practical. He offers wisdom, but it's not simply meant to just go in and think about it. The whole point behind it is to engage using this wise attention, using this exploration of experience. The fifth parami is energy. And when we begin to engage in this wise attention, engage in this practice of observing our experience, when we start to see the benefits of skillful behavior, of skillful action, and begin to understand the suffering and see how the mind begins to let go of it through the seeing, as I described that kind of winding out of anger, as when you take your foot off the accelerator pedal. As we begin to see the benefits, energy arises for more exploration. So engaging in this practice, we begin to see how it serves us, and it's kind of a feedback loop. We get energy as we engage in the practice. It's a little counterintuitive. As we make effort in the practice, it actually cultivates energy. Often we think of it the other way around. We think we need effort. We need energy. I'm sorry, we think we need energy in order to make effort. That without energy, we can't make effort. And there's some truth to that. We need to have some life. We have to have some life force going in order to make some effort. But we really need very minimal amount of energy to begin to engage. Small moments of engaging and looking at our experience. Just a split second of knowing, a split second, just moment after moment after moment. It doesn't have to be a heavy striving. In this moment, do you have the energy to feel your butt on the floor? Feel your hands. Hear my voice. It doesn't take much. It's not that hard. So beginning to engage in that way, we get a little bit more energy as we make the effort, and it kind of just builds slowly over time. The next one, the sixth one, patience is very closely related to energy in some ways. There's kind of three aspects of patience, one being persistence, which is very closely related to energy. It's essentially what I was just talking about, that just keep going, just keep engaging. Anytime you remember, keep engaging, keep engaging, keep exploring. So persistence is one aspect of patience. And so patience is said to perfect energy because as we cultivate patience, it perfects this quality of persistence. Just being able to keep going even if we feel like not much is happening. Then there's an aspect of tolerance, of being willing to forbear tolerance of suffering, tolerance of burden, the burdensome nature of our experience. not to simply sit back and let it roll over us, but to not, I think I'll use another analogy from Gandhi, that you know, tolerance from the perspective of Gandhi when looking at the situation in India with the British rule, tolerance wasn't about accepting the situation. It was about being tolerant with the process of change, the slow process of change. That engaging with nonviolent, non-passive, non-cooperation with the British rule, there was a slow transformation. So it was tolerance with the process of transformation. Essentially, not tolerance of the injustice. So it's kind of a distinction there. So we don't simply sit back. If there's injustice in the world, we don't simply necessarily sit back and say, oh, yes, you know, everything's fine the way it is. Just, you know, be with what is. We can engage to change, to make change. Hopefully coming from skillful intention, compassion, kindness, as opposed to anger and hatred, and being patient with the process of change, patient, tolerant of the process, essentially patience with results. Patience with how long it takes for results to manifest. We need this kind of patience in our meditation practice because this is a slow process of transformation. There can be moments of insight, of just blinding seeing, wow, yes, that's the way it is. I see how impermanent things are. But much of our practice is about simply, very slowly, wearing down our habits of mind over and over by simply turning our attention to them, feeling the manifestation of it in our body, in our minds, feeling the suffering of it over and over again. It's like wearing it down, wearing it down, wearing it down. The Buddha gave an analogy of the practice as being kind of like if there's a shipwreck on a shore and there's pieces of wood and pieces of rope from the ship on the shore, he said that, you know, the sun, the sand, the wind will slowly wear away at those pieces of the ship. Just slowly, slowly over time, it'll wear away. And you might not, for years, seeing that rope lying there, you might not see any change to the rope. It might not be obvious to you that the rope is getting soggy and falling apart from the inside. And one day, you go and try to pick up that rope, and it just falls apart. Our practice can happen this way. That we think we're engaging, you know, it's like, will this ever end, this impatience I feel, or this anger? Just keep looking at it over and over and over again. It's as if the sun, the sand, and the wind, the mindfulness is wearing away at it really slowly, really slowly. And usually reflecting back over a long period of time, say 10 years or 5 years, you can probably see, you can start to see over time, oh, I'm not as reactive as I used to be. Things aren't so difficult for me anymore. And I didn't really see that happening. It's just different now. So our practice has this quality much of the time. Much of the time. I really love this analogy. I'm so happy it's there that the Buddha talked about that, because there's so much emphasis, it seems, on these, you know, breakthrough insights and, Now, that's kind of the way our culture works. We think we need to have things happen quickly and that it's got to be a big explosion of some sort. Most of my practice has come in this more slow, gradual wearing down. Patience. The next one is truthfulness. And this is really, I think of this as beyond truthfulness of speech, because that was back in virtue. This is more about seeing through delusion, essentially. That beginning to look at our filters, the way that we view the world, the assumptions we make about the world, and beginning to become aware of the fact that we are not seeing the true nature of things. That we have these glasses on that essentially filter our view, filter our experience through a view. With a particular view, we can only see certain things. It's like we've got blinders on when we have a particular view that we're looking at the world through. So truthfulness is about beginning to uncover these delusions. This is a kind of a deeper truthfulness, a truthfulness of contacting the truth of reality. And our delusions are pretty deeply ingrained, and there's, you know, four standard delusions that are talked about. Here's the delusion of believing something is permanent when it's impermanent. There's the delusion of believing that something will be happiness producing when it is the opposite of happiness producing. There's the delusion of seeing self in what is not self. And there's the delusion of seeing something beautiful and what is not beautiful. So I don't have time to go into detail on these, but explore in your experience when you... We know things aren't impermanent. Impermanence is a really good delusion to look at, because we know in our minds that things are not permanent. I mean, you know, everybody knows this. You know, you ask anybody out on the street, do things change? And they'll say yes. But there's a difference between an intellectual understanding of it and the real experiential meeting of that truth. And there's a way in which, even though we know intellectually that things are impermanent, there's a way in which we engage with things as if they were permanent. So looking at that, when you're looking at things through that view, can you begin to touch into the truth underlying it? The next one is determination or resolve. And this one is a quality that I really like to talk about, and I've talked about especially early on in the 5-week class on daily life practice, because resolve is so crucial, not only for our meditation practice, but for our daily life practice. That, you know, this isn't a one-time deal. We don't simply say, okay, I'm going to try to do this, and then never think about it again. We have to make the resolve over and over and over and over again to keep engaging, keep trying. It's connected to effort in a way, that we have to just keep saying, I'm just going to keep trying. I'm just going to keep trying. It's not a one-time deal. We have to come back over and over and over again. So it's an active quality, resolve. I think in our culture, we tend to think of it as a, okay, I'm going to do something. And, you know, just if we resolve to do it, somehow we will do it. But in this context, it's much more of a dynamic quality, something that we keep touching into over and over again. Seems like in our culture, we feel like, well, if we make a resolve and we break it, then, well, that's over and done with. You know, it's not like that. You know, we make a resolve, we notice that we get lost and we make the resolve again. Just keep resolving. Keep determining what the path, what the direction we want to head our lives in. We have a choice in what direction we want to head our lives in. And we can use this quality of determination to help set that direction. It really is a kind of a intention setting, the use of this resolve. Then there's loving kindness. Opening of the heart. And this happens to us as we engage in this practice. There are active practices that we can engage in to cultivate loving kindness. But the heart opens. This is one of the real, a lot of people find as they begin to engage in this practice of mindfulness, we meet ourselves, we meet our own suffering. And something about that begins to open our hearts to the suffering of others. There's a way in which contacting our own suffering opens our hearts to others. So the heart begins to open. And the tenth quality is equanimity. This is a quality of balance of mind, where we're not swayed by all the difficulties and all the pleasures of life. We meet what comes with balance, with peacefulness, with ease. This quality, it's a beautiful, beautiful quality of mind. And sometimes when people hear about balance of mind, they think it means that, you know, oh, you meet the sorrows and the joys of life. So it means you're not really feeling much when your mind is balanced. It's not reactive. So it means you're not feeling. So essentially, equanimity, another way to talk about equanimity is non-reactivity. And people hear that and think it means you're not feeling anything. But in actually, I think it means very much not that. But as we get very balanced in our mind, we can actually feel more deeply the joys and the sorrows of the world. It's like when we are reactive, we close down. When we meet suffering and we react to it, there's a closing down that we can't really take it in. When the heart is non-reactive, it can take in much more of a wider range of joy and sorrow and stay balanced. Now, this balance isn't necessarily it's non-reactive, but it's not necessarily a passive state. I can't remember the exact quote, but there's a beautiful discussion of the mind that is free, or a beautiful phrase. It's something like, it's luminous, it's clear, and ceaselessly responsive. Responding exactly in the appropriate way to the situation. So the equanimous mind is not it's non-reactive in the sense that it's not blown around by it, but it's also very responsive. So working with these paramis in general, working with them, there's kind of two main approaches to working with qualities of mind. And the first one is basically to look at what gets in its way. That's one way to cultivate a quality, is to study its opposite. So if you want to understand patience, study impatience. If you want to understand kindness, study where you are unkind. So you start to see the things that are blocking the quality. It's very much these qualities, many of them, there are ways that we can cultivate them actively. And that's the other way, you know, the two main approaches. Cultivate the quality actively through active practices and study what gets in its way. So observing the opposite quality of mind, observing impatience, for example, if you want to understand or study patience, as we begin to see impatience and see how it essentially, you know, the opposite quality, it kind of blocks the natural manifestation of the positive quality. So when impatience doesn't exist, patience begins to naturally manifest. When unkindness doesn't exist, kindness begins to naturally manifest. So that's how studying the opposite quality begins to lead towards the positive quality. So I like to encourage creativity with these practices, particularly around the positive cultivation of these qualities in our daily lives. You know, as I said, some of these qualities have some specific practices, like loving kindness, for example, has some specific practices that can be used to cultivate loving kindness, some specific meditative approaches to cultivating loving kindness. Equanimity has some specific meditative approaches towards cultivating it. And be creative. Be creative around, if you're interested in exploring one of these qualities, see if you can find ways to connect with that positive quality and find ways to cultivate it. Generosity, for example. You know, one practice that Gil likes to suggest sometimes is to put a $20 bill in your pocket and look for somewhere to give it away. You know, just don't give it away to the first place, but wait, you know, have it in your pocket intending to give it away. And going through your world, going through your day, look for the opportunity where it feels right to give that $20 bill away. So we can be creative around these practices, finding ways that resonate with you to exploring cultivation of these qualities. Another way to cultivate one of the main ways to cultivate both the positive side and the understanding of the opposite quality is simply through mindfulness. Recognize when the quality is present. Recognize when its opposite is present. When you recognize that, and one thing that I've discovered is, like, impatience, for example, is one quality that I have studied a lot. It seems to come up for me a lot. And, you know, observing impatience, I see it a lot. It's all over the place. And I also see that there are times when it's not there. So it's, you know, kind of like, there's kind of an identity I have around impatience. You know, there's some kind of, you know, strong, habitual, impatient quality there. And then seeing where impatience is not there begins to poke holes in that identity. It's like, no, I'm not always impatient. It's something that appears. It's something that disappears. Patience does manifest. Sometimes we neglect to see that we actually do manifest these beautiful qualities. So begin to notice when they appear, when patience is here, when truthfulness is here, when kindness appears. Begin to let yourself touch into that these things do appear for us. So over the next few weeks, we will be exploring in much more detail each one of these. And I'd like to encourage you to, week by week, just find ways to engage with that quality in your daily life. each week, have that be a kind of a theme for the week. So with generosity, for example, next week will be the discussion on generosity. For the week, thinking about looking at the quality when it's present, looking at places where you feel ungenerous or stingy, looking at ways to cultivate the quality, ways to creatively play with generosity. So using the exploration, particularly in your daily life, because these qualities come up and their opposites come up for us over and over and over again. So use them as a fuel for this wise attention. So I'm going to be away for the next 4 weeks, and I've asked 4 people to come and talk on each of the first 4 paramis for the next 4 weeks. And then when I'm back, I'm going to be teaching a retreat up in Washington State for most of that time. And when I'm back, I'll pick up and continue with the series and explore each of these qualities in more detail. So have a good month. I'll see you when I get back.